Welcome to a World of Good podcast. I'm Nate Tapman.
And I'm Andrew Gale.
And we are two friends
who love Jesus,
care about the church,
and travel the world to share stories of people who do the same.
Our conversations happen in all kinds of places,
like a coffee shop in an airport terminal,
or even the back of a crowded taxi.
But no matter where we go, from Argentina to Zimbabwe,
we capture stories of the good God is doing around the world.
And we hope those stories will do you a world of good.
Welcome to a World of Good podcast. My name is Nate Tapman, and I am by myself today. Andrew was not able to be here for this recording. Actually, he's in between a couple of trips right now and needed to spend this time with his family. So I went ahead and gave him the day off, gave him a paid vacation day off so that he can go and enjoy a Starbucks with his wife. I have no authority or power to do that. I just made that up. So I guess if he wanted to go buy a Starbucks on me, I'd be happy to pay for that for him. But anyway, we're so thankful that you're here. This is episode 4 of season 4. And if you haven't had a chance yet, really encourage you to go back and listen to the first 2 episodes or the previous 2 episodes. We had our intro episode, and then in episode 2, we spoke with Esther Jadhav on cultural intelligence. And in episode 3, we spoke with Pastor Chris Kazmarek and just talking about trip planning. And again, this is all a part of our trips series, our short-term missions trip series that we are talking through right now. And today, I am happy to introduce Kelly and Rhonda Phillips. They are here with us today, or here with me today, I guess. They have spent almost 3 decades on the mission field. And as Andrew and I were brainstorming on topics that we wanted to talk about in regards to trips, missions trips, we wanted to hear from the perspective of missionaries on the field who have opened up their homes, opened up their communities and cities, and opened up their schedules to host teams. And Kelly and Rhonda, again, they've been on the field for almost 30 years, and they have a tremendous, obviously they have a tremendous experience in missions, but also they're very respected by a lot of people. And I know a lot of people who have gone on trips to their field and their lives have been changed because of it. And yes, part of that is probably the place they traveled to, the things that they learned. But I know also part of those life-changing experiences came because they were impacted by Kelly and Rhonda in their ministry. And so we were happy that they were able to join us. So Kelly and Rhonda, thank you for being a part of our episode and our podcast. And maybe just give us a little bit of background of how you ended up where you are today, where you started from, and that journey that led you to where you are today.
Sure. You want to do it? Nope. Me? Okay. We left Florida in 1993 to do church planning it was then the Missionary Board, Church of God. We worked in developing a church in Chelyabinsk, Russia, which is over in the Urals of Russia, for 9 years. And so we transitioned in 2002 to Budapest, Hungary. And we're the regional coordinators for Europe and the Middle East during that time. We were there for 5 years and then transitioned in 2007 to Berlin, Germany. Got to Berlin and saw all kinds of different opportunities and asked to be released from the regional coordinator position and went back into kind of some experimental, church planning, house church experiments and things like that. And that's led us into needs within Berlin. And that's led us into the ministry that we're involved in now.
We've been in Berlin for 14 years now?
About 14 years. No. Yeah. Oh, it would be 2001. For the School of Theology, we look at faith in a post-Christian society. And although Germany and Berlin still has kind of some remnants of the Christian faith, most of society is kind of moving in a different direction, is very secular. And so we look at the factors that played into the faith roles in Berlin over over time, actually, in this case, over the centuries, we go up to Wittenberg, where Martin Luther was, and the Reformation beginning there. And that was, you know, 5 centuries ago. So, you know, we begin there. We look at every time we're asking the question, where was the community of God? Where were the people of God? And so we look at it during the early times of the Reformation. And then Berlin's just a great place to look at it during the time of National Socialism or Nazism. And look at where the people of faith were. And we look at people like Dietrich Bonhoeffer. And then we go into the Cold War, post-World War II. And into modern day Berlin and look at expressions of faith communities and people of faith during that time.
What is it about hosting a team that makes it either worthwhile or difficult from your guys' experience?
Well, I would say what makes it worthwhile is definitely the watching the aha moments for not only the group that's here, but for us as well, where they can connect the dots of faith and history and even the topic that our ministry is involved in. Definitely the relationships and the connection that happens during that time is just amazing to have teams here and have that. The encouragement that teams bring and seeing our world that we've become so used to, Berlin for the last 14 years, from their perspective. So we are not just hosting them and showing them our world and our perspective in our world, but we're open and really excited when they can share their experiences and their perspective of our world too. So the curiosity and discovery part of that is probably our favorite part, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely. And when that church understands your context, then yeah, it's then the conversations really change from then forward, whether you're on a Zoom call with them or visiting them in the States. They say, yeah, sure. You know, how's this thing going? And it's all related to context then.
And sure. Another part that I absolutely love is getting feedback months or even years later of people in these groups that we have hosted. And they talk about how that impacted their daily life or how it impacted the way that they see community or how they see diversity. We just love to get the feedback, the emails, the phone calls from people who have been on the trips.
Mm. And I imagine from my own personal experiences, I mean, it is interesting in how well you can get to know some people on some of these trips. And so, I mean, the relationships that are formed and started in some cases, and as you said, to be able to get that feedback and to carry on those relationships and communications months, if not years later, that has to be something that you appreciate time and time again. Because I think, you know, I can speak from both sides in regards to taking a team and going to visit missionaries and the context, but then also beginning to feel a little bit that experience on the other side of receiving teams and hosting teams. And there's a lot of work that goes into it that until you're on the receiving end, you don't really understand. Would you say is that a difficult component of receiving teams is just the time and energy spent in preparing and planning, or are there other things that, you know, that make these trips, again, difficult may not be the right word, or maybe there's a different way to describe it, but what makes it difficult or challenging in receiving teams?
Yeah, I wouldn't say difficult. I think it is what it is. It's definitely challenging. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that it takes days to really prep the group to get there, make sure that all the last minute information, all the small details are in line. And then in Berlin, we have to kind of worry about how weather or something would affect the trip. And so we always have to have plan B and C in our hip pocket ready to go. So yeah, it's challenging, but yeah, of course, the benefit outweighs any of that.
I would say a couple of other challenges is once the group gets to us, that we really ask for their patience, because it takes a few days for us to really figure out the vibe of the group, the needs of the group. Yeah. What they can and can't do physically, because our tours in Berlin especially are pretty physically challenging. And so, yeah, it takes time for us to figure that out in the first few days.
There are some groups that that you say, okay, we need to be ready to leave at 5:30, and they're ready at 5:25. And there are other groups that are like, you know, 5:45. And so after a couple of days, you kind of get used to, you know, how you need to adjust for it all. Yeah, and it works out.
Yeah. And the time especially is crucial when we're doing public transportation. You have to be at the bus stop or be at the train stop at certain times. But yeah, I mean, those are extremely challenging. Another challenge, though, that I think maybe groups don't really know about is that when we're hosting the group, our normal work is put to the side because we are totally focused on the group. And so, yeah, it takes us time after they're gone to really catch up, or we do in at night, late into the night, catch up on the work that we were normally doing on a day like that.
Yeah. And that's, you know, again, even when groups are visiting, that's still a side that they don't see. They still don't get to see the work that you guys do on the field, because as you said, you've put that to the side. And so, you know, they get to see your work through hosting them. And in some cases, maybe they think that's all you do is you host people and take them on trips, and who wouldn't want to live that life, right?
That's right.
So as I mentioned in our opening, we've been having these conversations, you know, talking about the importance of cultural intelligence and, you know, having that curiosity of learning from and learning about another culture and asking questions and also just preparing for a trip and preparing, you know, as a missions pastor or a trip leader, you know, what is it that you do to help prepare your team in a cross-cultural experience for 7 to 10, sometimes 14 days? What, maybe just share a little bit from your own personal experiences. Why are these topics important from your perspective in hosting teams?
Well, I think one thing is that we have such a short amount of time with the team on the ground that we want every moment to count. And so if the attitudes have been adjusted, the curiosity has really been amped up, assumptions kind of put away for a while, it gives us the ability to kind of open our world to others. If that's not done, it really interferes with trying to move through a very different context than most Americans live in.
What are some other things that are important in terms of maybe whether it's skills or skills to obtain or training or something to learn or information to get? What are some other things that people can do to help prepare themselves or a group in coming on a missions trip?
Well, for us, when they come to Berlin, they do a lot of walking. I mean, a lot. We have one day that's close to like 10 miles. And so when we say a lot of walking, we have people that have come and said, you told us there was a lot of walking, but this is more than a lot of walking. So some things you can't over stress with what to expect. The other piece is to do some reading. I mean, we always encourage people, especially if they're coming to Berlin, to read something about Dietrich Bonhoeffer, maybe his biography, which is maybe too big, or something that he's written like Cost of Discipleship. And at least for a segment of what we're going through, it reveals his world in a certain period of time in Berlin, which we're, you know, in the midst of kind of investigating at that time.
I would add to that in groups preparing to come to really go to any place, not just to Berlin, but the leader makes or breaks the group.
Oh man, yeah.
And they just have to be very careful in choosing the right leader for that trip. If this is a person from the big city who has never visited a third world country, they're going to struggle. And when you have a leader struggling, it just makes it that much more difficult for the person who is hosting them on the ground. The other thing that we feel is really important, and most of the groups that have come here, the leaders have done a good job at this.
Excellent job.
Is vetting those who are interested. They put out a call, we're going to Berlin, and they may have 20 people. We limit our groups to usually no more than 8 people. We think that that's that they can get the best experience and move around Berlin.
But we've had up to 18.
We've had up to 18, but we encourage only 8. But that vetting process is really important. And to ask the person who is hosting you for guidance in that. And like Kelly said, Berlin is physically demanding. For other countries, dietary restrictions just wouldn't be able to be accommodated. People who are not flexible, just really to vet those people who are coming, to check out their cultural intelligence, their experience, if they're open, if they're curious, those things really, really matter. I also think that some training needs to be done on the moral sharing of stories.
Yes. I'm glad you brought that up.
I've seen a lot of stories after people have gone on trips and they're sharing in churches or in small groups. Mm. And the focus is me, and what I did, and I did this, and those poor people over there. So I think the attitude has to be adjusted to be learning how Jesus sees the world around them, and then be able to apply that to their lives upon returning. Ask your host about sharing photos. There, I think that there's a lot of exploitation that takes place when groups are visiting orphanages in third world countries, and all these photos of children are just plastered everywhere on social media and everywhere. And I think we need to take a look at that as churches and missions pastors, especially. What is going to be your policy on the moral sharing of stories to keep the people in focus? And it's not all about me. Also having the attitude that we're not only there to give, but to receive as well. And to have the attitude that those who offer help and those that need help, we are both. We are in both of those categories. So being open to learning from the place and the people that you're interacting with.
I think the other thing here is also for this profound understanding that you're not there by yourself or even just with the group, but you're representing the Christian faith and you're representing the United States in many ways. And so I think those are two big, huge responsibilities that the groups have. And we've seen that with not groups that we've hosted, but watching other groups go terribly wrong.
You've raised a lot of good points. I want to go back to a couple of those and just review them a little bit.
Sure.
One of the first ones you talked about was how a leader can make or break a group. When you're hosting a team, how much communication do you want to have with a leader?
Oh, a lot. Yeah. A lot with the pre-field too, so that we're on the same page. And when maybe challenges arise, the leader can readily step in and kind of resolve whatever issue there may be. With the larger group that we had a person in the group make a request that had been, it was kind of the subject of the request had been gone over in the pre-field stuff, but they decided to kind of slip it in again. And then the pre-field stuff, we said, we're not going to do that. And so as soon as this person in the group said, hey, when are we going to blah, 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 the pastor just turned around and said, that's not happening. And he never missed a beat. And everybody said, no, it's not happening. So, those are great.
We do like a lot of communication. First, usually through emails, Zoom calls. We also make an info sheet that we send that talks about cultural aspects to expect, what to pack, how much walking is involved, food expectations, it's just, it covers a lot of stuff. And then we like to have a Zoom call or video call with the leader of the trip and those who are coming on the trip to go over that info sheet with them one more time and then be able to answer some of the questions that they have.
That's great. And so you're doing a lot of maybe what would normally be done in the first day or so of arriving. You're actually doing that before they arrive and then maybe doing a refresher or something when they get there.
Yep.
Yeah.
We do it the day they arrive too, usually.
And then that's when I shouldn't make assumptions. You send out all the info and you assume everybody's on the same page, but you're right, Nate. You have to go over it. I learned the hard way on that one.
A little refresher course.
Yeah.
And I know it may be more specific to the European context, but you talked about how eight people on a team is kind of an ideal number, and you kind of referenced it a little bit in terms of kind of getting around, but maybe just kind of speak into that a little bit more. You know, what does a trip entail with eight people versus a team of 18 people?
Well, the public transportation, for one, when you have eight people, it's easier to get on and off all the public transportation and navigate that and not lose someone. When you have 18 or 20 people, it just makes it that much more complicated. Also, restaurants in Europe have a tendency to be small. And there are not a lot of restaurants that accommodate huge groups. And so that's a factor too.
Yeah. Yeah, when you get on a crowded bus you're packed like sardines. If you add eight more people, if you try to add 12 more people, I mean, there may be some people standing there. And especially if I'm an American and this is all new to me and pressing up against someone to get on public transportation isn't my gig, it's going to be problematic.
Mm-hmm. Going back, also the walking aspect of it, I in America, man, we are so used to driving everywhere. You know, it's a pain in the butt if we just have to park our vehicle out, you know, really far away from the store and walk across the parking lot. But in Europe, that's the main mode of transportation is walking, taking the metro, taking the bus. That's how everybody gets around. And so it is, I mean, just the public transportation and getting around in Berlin and other cities is a cross-cultural experience that in and of itself, you can learn a lot about a culture just by doing that.
Yes. You know, we had one of our guests one time, we were on the subway, the U-Bahn here in Berlin. And the person, I said, we're getting ready to get off, but the person left about 2.5-3 feet between them and the door. And
because of personal space.
Because of, you know, U.S. personal space.
Yep.
And the other people on the public transportation looked at them and thought, they're not getting off. And so when everybody started crowding in front of this person to get off, they raised their voice and said, well, excuse me. And I was mortified. No. I'm like, no. You were the one that made the culture here, not them.
So that's what I'd say. Behavior matters. Just always be accommodating and polite, even if you feel frustrated.
Well, okay, we're gonna turn the corner here. We're gonna start talking about the reputation that Americans have when traveling abroad. I was gonna kind of wait a little bit, but I think it is important for us as Americans and Americans visiting, again, speaking in more of a European context, German context, I think it's important that we, you know, come into that culture with the knowledge of what others think about our culture and coming from the U.S. And so maybe just in general, maybe through a story or just share what is it that non-Americans say about Americans when they visit with you?
I mean, by and large, the places that we've been, whether it's been in Russia or Hungary, here in Germany, people have loved our American guests. I mean, just loved our American guests. They will observe that they tend to be loud.
They observe. That's a great, nice way to say that.
Yeah.
That's their observation.
And you can see it gets kind of fun sometimes, but when you're trying to observe the culture, you miss so many things when you're the loudest person in the subway or on the bus or in any given place. And so, Yeah. The other piece is like, it's common. It's a cultural piece to take off your shoes when you enter mm-hmm. someone's house or apartment here in Germany. It's because, especially in the big cities, those sidewalks are extremely dirty. I mean, there is mm-hmm. everything you can imagine on that sidewalk. And to track that all over someone's house just isn't polite. But yeah, you sometimes that's a hard tradition to get used to. I don't want to have to take my shoes off, put them on and tie them again. But yeah, but overall, the people that we've ministered with in this part of the world have just loved their American guests.
I would like to add one cultural element that yeah. even surprises me when I go back to the States, because we've been living for 14 years. Well, even Russia was like this, yeah. a very stoic society, that they are very quiet. And in the States, you just talk to everyone. You're in the grocery store mm-hmm. line, you're just stopping people on the sidewalk even, and you talk to everyone. But when you're in another culture, that can really be shocking for them. So I would encourage Americans that travel to Europe, especially, because I think in most cultures, European cultures, they're pretty quiet, is to listen more than you talk and to stay curious and ask thoughtful questions, that they just don't want to do small talk with you all the time.
We had a guest one time, and we were on one of the Berlin double-decker buses, and we were up top. It was pretty full. And she looks around and she says, "These Germans don't look anything like the Germans that live in my town." And all oh, Germans, no. English, they kind of turned around like, "What?" Yeah.
Oh, no.
She had a great time, and she really discovered some really good stuff. She was very curious. And so she had a good time, but we were like, "Oh, well, there you go."
I also think that Americans get their mind made up on something, that this is what I want to do here. This is what I want to experience here, and to take a back seat and allow others to lead and have input into you during this time. I think that's really important. Also, Americans carry a lot of luggage. Well, you have a good story about that one, don't you? In Moscow, all those luggage.
Oh, no, we have a strict policy. If you can't carry it, don't bring it. That's right. I mean, because you're going to, and it's not that I'm not going to try to help someone if they're struggling with something, but you can't help everybody at the same time. And so, yeah, when we were in Russia, I had gone over to Moscow to bring a group into Chelyabinsk, and it was a bigger group. And they were traveling with a lot of luggage. I mean, a lot of luggage, just before this only bring what you can carry policy. So
we learned.
And so we're going to go by train from Moscow to Chelyabinsk, which was about 36 hours. It's a long train ride. And so we ordered a bus to pick us up at the hotel, to take us to the train station. Long story short, the bus was extremely late and only got us to the train station maybe 10 minutes before the train was supposed to leave. Now, we had to navigate through the train station. They could not carry what they had brought, so we had to get the luggage guys with their carts to help us when they figured out which train we were on and how short a time we had, and that we were Americans. They really gouged us on the price.
Well, sure.
They loaded up like, I think there are four big carts, just maybe 7 foot piled with different suitcases and trunks and stuff that they had brought. And there was a luggage car on the very back of the train. Well, as we get to the platform, and we've got 5 minutes now, and I tell the group, go find the train car and your seats and get in your seats. And I have to get this luggage on the train. Me along with these luggage guys, we started shuffling it through this little passageway and piling luggage. There were luggage guys inside the train car that were pulling them through. But towards the end, they just couldn't keep up with all this luggage. And so it just kind of stacked up and it filled this little corridor and the doorway into the train car. Before we get the last piece on, the train starts actually moving. And it's moving. And so the luggage guy is pushing the cart along with the train, and we're still stuffing luggage onto the train. At the last minute, I hand the guy the money that he actually had earned that day. He was a big Russian man. He picked me up off my feet. I was younger and lighter then. he is a Russian tradition. He kissed me squarely on the lips, and then he flipped me around facing the car and kind of pasted me up against the doorway that is now full of luggage, but there are two handles and a little foot ledge. And so his wagon stops in the platform, and I am doing the kind of, it was fun, the Indiana Jones thing on the outside of the train riding through Moscow. It took them about 10 minutes to finally get to me, but they're yelling all the time, "Are you still out there?"
Oh, my word.
But yeah, we
had to be. And was that during winter as well? Was it freezing cold out? I mean,
it probably was fall or spring, because it wasn't extremely cold. Now it was a pleasant adventure.
Oh my word. Like, do you have any idea how many pieces of luggage there actually was?
Well, with this group, there were close to 50 pieces.
Oh gee. And how many people?
There were only 10 people.
5 pieces of luggage per person.
Yeah.
Wow.
This was, you know, pre 9/11. It was the big, they couldn't have big steamer trunks like in the good old days, but yeah, they could.
And it was after this trip that you instituted your one piece of luggage policy on any trips, on any teams.
Yeah, that's exactly when we instituted our first piece of luggage per person, and a piece of luggage that they can actually carry.
Yeah.
Oh. Well, there's a couple of times throughout your stories and things that you guys shared where you talk about some of these things that maybe Americans might observe about the cultures you've lived in that they often misinterpret. Do you have some real life examples or some specifics or some thoughts about that? Some things that Americans might observe or have observed that they misinterpret in your context.
Mm-hmm. I have a story. You know, Russian women love, when they're walking in public together and talking, to do it linked arm in arm or to be very close to each other. And there were a few times in groups that came that commented on the number of lesbians in Russia. And I said, no, it's just how Russian women are. When they walk and they're talking to one another, they link arms and they like to be really close to each other.
You often see that in Africa and the Middle East as well. And yeah. So it has nothing to do with sexuality.
Yeah. And Andrew, forgive me, listeners, if you've heard this story before, or sorry, Andrew, if I'm spoiling a story for you, but I know Andrew's talked about this as well. I believe there's been times, I don't know if multiple times or one time, but when he has had to hold hands with another pastor. And again, it's about the relationship. It's about the connection. It has nothing to do with sexuality. And so, but again, that's where our American mindset goes. And I, you know, you share so many of these stories and observations, and I just keep thinking back in my own personal experience. I think, yep, that's what I thought too when I saw that, or yep, that's what I did, that exact same thing. And so well, this goes back to the cultural intelligence thing, doesn't it? In terms of, if our minds are closed, if we think that we have all the answers, if we think that our customs, our cultures, our context is the right one or more superior, we're probably in for a rude awakening when it comes to visiting other cultures. And it is so important to ask questions, to have an open mind, you know. And as our family has moved to Spain and has, you know, become more and more accustomed to people not smiling. Now, again, it's a little bit more difficult with the masks, but, you know, we're from Indiana and you smile at strangers all the time. you know, regardless if you're in a bad mood or if you're angry or upset, if you make eye contact with a stranger, you're going to nod or give a half smile or say hello or do something. But it's taken our family quite a long time to get used to somebody just looking at you and you make no facial recognition whatsoever. And you just keep walking by that person. It is very hard. Because and we've had long conversations about this as a family, and it has led to other conversations and topics as well. But it comes down to, you know, how I feel in that moment. And I feel like I'm being mean to that person, or that person doesn't like me. You know, the focus really is on myself. And it's not, again, not right or wrong. It's just that's the way that this culture operates and how they move around, and they don't just readily open themselves up to complete strangers on the street. They're a little bit more closed in that way.
Those stoic cultures. Yeah.
Very much. Very much.
Yeah. I think, yeah, you're exactly right.
We had a guest one time and we'd kind of gone over this, but I mean, and I understood why. They said, I just couldn't help myself. And so they were smiling at people, but we happened to be down in the red light district. And so it came across as a come on. I'm like, okay, this isn't good. So let me explain what's happening. And the person was like, oh, I won't do it anymore. But yeah.
I think you're exactly right when you're talking about not seeing other cultures as right or wrong, different cultural things, but to see them as different and try to understand more about your own feelings and emotions and even your views on certain things. We had a women's group here one time, and one of my very close friends in Berlin is a young Muslim woman. And I had arranged for this women's group to have a tea time with my friend. And, you know, post 9/11, all these cultural attitudes toward Muslims, oh, they're all terrorists, they're horrible people. There was one woman that just said, oh, really? Do we have to do this? I don't want to do this, but good for her. She came to the tea. And after it was done, she was weeping and said, you know, I learned a lot about myself today. And I got out of bed this morning just dreading this. And I almost didn't come. And I'm just so glad I did, because when you put a face or are in relationship with someone who is different than you, you learn tolerance for diversity. You learn so much about yourself and your views, and can really build strong friendships.
That's great. And that's a great story. I think kind of wrap up our conversation here. Thank you guys so much. But before I let you go, one of the things that we like to ask our guest, the name of our podcast is A World of Good. And so one of the things that we like to ask is just what good is happening in your world today? What are the good things that God is doing in your world?
Well, in our ministry, some incredible things are happening. The world changed and is constantly adapting and changing since the pandemic. But that's given us the opportunity with the people group we're working with to really kind of scale up the operation that we were in. It just gave us some opportunities that we hadn't had before. And so that's a good piece. And this weekend, we were just in a Church of God congregation over in Hanover. And it was delightful. The neighborhood this congregation is in, they're over.
Extremely diverse.
Yes, very diverse. There were over 100, I think 120 different nationalities that lived in a relatively small area surrounding the church. And when you go in the church, that's exactly what you see. Wow. This diversity, and there was just this uplifting spirit. I mean, you felt so much better when you walked out the doors, and I think that's what church should be. Shouldn't it? So, yeah, there's some great things happening. Another piece with groups here in Europe and the Middle East, we have an incredible team, and so many times
if we're going to have a group and it's a little more than we can handle, we'll have a teammate that comes in and tags up with us and walks with us through the whole thing, or at least part of it, that kind of relieves some of our burden. So
yeah, our three worlds teammates, it's just so good being on a team where we love each other, we have fun with each other, we grow together. I know that with one of the teammates, we read a book and we go through it together. And every week we meet and we talk about our book and the feelings that we have and the growth areas that can take place in our lives. And so, yeah, we're just really thankful for that, this great team that we have.
Yeah, for sure. And the new bosses that you guys just received.
Yeah. Well, I don't know about them yet. Don't say anything, but yeah.
Yeah, I must apologize. I did not make that connection to our listeners beforehand, but many people know that Stacy and I are the regional coordinators for Europe and the Middle East, and Kelly and Rhonda are on our team. And so we have the opportunity to work directly with them and learning from them and their vast experience. And as they said, that is one of the great things about our team is that we're interchangeable in regards to, we can help each other out. We can go and travel into each other's context and pick one another up and walk alongside of each other as groups come in or as we host different events and things like that. And so it makes our work a lot of fun in that we get to visit each other's fields. But then also, so many times we hear about missionaries who feel isolated and alone. And in our region, we try to negate that by allowing ourselves to travel and work with one another. And so we very much have that team approach. So that has worked very, very well for the last decade or so. Well, thank you guys. Is there anything else that you want to share with our listeners before we let you go?
Are you still going to give me 20 euros if I say something good about you?
Well, I guess I have to now that it's on recording. What am I supposed to say to that? Sure. Go ahead.
Just for the listeners, we're here because we have such a wonderful faith family back in the United States that prays for us. They encourage us. Mm. They support us financially and they come to visit us, and it makes it all possible. So yeah, shout out to all the great supporters there.
Mm, that's great. That's great. We couldn't do what we do.
Absolutely not.
Yeah. Yeah. All right. Well, thank you guys so much. We appreciate you, your work, your experiences, and being able to share those with us. Hopefully our listeners can take what you have shared with us today and apply it to their context. Hopefully it's made them think differently about trips or doing something different on a trip. Maybe it's coming to Germany and
yeah,
with one piece of luggage that they can carry.
And, maybe even like a little backpack or something.
Yeah, you would not want, we would not want Kelly to have to throw 50 pieces of luggage onto a train right now. That would not be fair to him. So thank you guys. We love you guys, and we'll talk to you later.
Okay, thanks.
Thanks for listening to A World of Good. A World of Good is a podcast production of Global Strategy and Church of God Ministries. Our theme song is Colorado by Leo Flores. If you want to join the conversation, visit us at Twitter at A World of Good Pod, on Instagram, A World of Good Podcast, or visit our website, chogglobal.org/A World of Good. And join us next time as we share more stories of good from around the world.